Okay, so we're going to look at this week's parsha. Last week also, we ended up doing a parsha share, which I posted on YU Torah. Just a quick cute story. My son Shmuel was down in North Carolina 2 weeks ago, and guy says to him, they're at a meal together, says, is your dad a rabbi? So he says, but he's not like practicing full time. He said, no, I'll tell you why I'm asking. He said, you look like this rabbi on YU Torah. So Shmuel's like, what? He says, yeah, we listened to this rabbi on YU Torah. You look like him. And Shmuel's like, yeah, that's my father. It ends up they're a young couple. They're Christian that are about to convert to Judaism. They've been studying for a couple of years now. And they somehow found the stuff on YU Torah. It's pretty unbelievable. North Carolina, Charlotte, North Carolina. And Shmuel happens to bump into them. It's pretty funny. Okay, but let's go. So it's Parshas Vayishlach coming up. And now when we go through these weeks of these stories, of the biblical stories in Genesis, they are extremely, extremely important for us as Jews in terms of our history, in terms of understanding where we come from, in terms of understanding where things are going. And that we have this idea that the Ramban, Nachmanides, puts out there called Ma'asa Avot Siman Labanim, that the act, what happened to our forefathers, to the patriarchs and the matriarchs, is a foreshadow of our history. What happens to us on a personal level, on a macro level. So this week, this parasha coming up, is Yaakov confronting Esav. And it is so, first of all, the story itself, we need to understand what's going on. It's very ambiguous. There's a tremendous amount of ambiguity. What I mean by that is, we'll read a line, and we'll look at the commentaries, and there'll be literally contradictory commentaries or explanations as to what the Torah is telling us. Or in the text itself, you'll have, just I'll give you an example. You have Yaakov will say something, Jacob will say something, and he'll refer to his brother, Esav. He'll say, my brother, and it will say Esav, and he'll then will say Esav, and he'll refer to him as his brother. But he'll actually be saying like that they're two people. It's not just Esav or who is my brother, but it's Esav and my brother. Like almost like there's a lot of strange things. Another example, this is when Yaakov goes and he has this encounter with the angel. So there's so many different explanations as to who is this angel. And here, let's jump to it quickly, just to see it inside. And it's very strange when we're trying to understand. It says he gets up that same night. He arose and taking his two wives, his maidservants and 11 children, he crossed the ford of the Jabbok, Mount Mavar Yabok. And then it says, after taking them across the stream, he sent across all his possessions. Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him until the break of dawn. And it says, it's like the weird, like, who is this? Like, who's this man? So Jacob goes out on his own. He's at night and has like a wrestling match with this mysterious man. Now, the Torah could tell us this. It leaves it so ambiguous. So why is it, what's going on here? Okay. So let's start from the beginning. I'm going to go back to the beginning of the Torah portion. We're going to go step by step. And hopefully, at least, we have to try to make sense of what's going on here. Because, just think about this, you know, the Torah is constructed, it has the five books, Genesis story is, it's not a storybook as much as it's clearly coming to give us important lessons, with this idea of just, like, giving this picture of, like, the future of, like, where we're coming from, understanding our identity, and the different lessons that are learned through these stories that God puts in together very tightly to try to convey certain messages to us. So we need to understand like what's being told to us, because if it was a history book, there's a lot missing from the book. there's a lot of their years and years of things that occurred to them that we just have no idea. It's just clearly coming and giving us these little snapshots. And so this story of the encounter is actually, it says in the Talmud that when the rabbis would go out to meet with Rome, they would study this parsha. This story is, there's something in here that when we talk about our confrontation with the Western culture, which is Rome, is embedded here. So whatever Yaakov is doing, whatever Jacob is doing here, he's kind of setting us up for the future in terms of a roadmap, so to speak, of how we are to approach Rome, to the Western world. Okay, so let's just see what goes on here. And also, let's understand what's going on for Jacob as well. Jacob sent messengers ahead to his brother Esau in the land of Seir, the country of Edom. So he sent messengers. Some say he sent actual angels, malachim. Vayishlach Yaakov malachim. So here we have this one word, malachim, which we have in the English as messengers, can be also interpreted as angels. Why do I say that? Well, Rashi says it, but also you see that we have two sentences earlier. It says, Jacob went on his way and the angels of God encountered him. Right? So you have two, right, in this chapter, really, I mean, even though it's in terms of the way the Torah has a break here, or there's you see that idea of angels of God, and then two sentences later, he's sending out malachim. It could be malachi elokim. So Rashi says, it could be that he sent out angels, or literally sent out messengers. Okay, fine. Ambiguity. Sends it to his brother Esav and to the land of Seir, to the Stay Adam. Okay, fine. So, and he instructed them as follows. So whoever these people are, whether they're actual messengers or angels, he instructs them. Thus shall you say to my lord Esav, thus says your servant Jacob, I stayed with Lavan and remained until now. In Lavan garti vecharadata. So say to my master, your servant Jacob. So he's like already like, you know, very like in a subservient way, he's approaching his brother. Now, again, this is all this history of how they left 22 plus 14, 36 early, 36, was it 22 plus 14, right? So they haven't seen each other in many years. And before this, he had taken the blessings. And now this is the first time they're confronting each other since he left home. And so he's saying to him, there's like embedded language here. I've been with Lavan and until now. Now, the idea of living with Lavan is the idea that he was able to perhaps be, you know, he's able to handle Lavan, who's known as, Lavan is like this very big trickster or a very sophisticated operator that he's able to go toe-to-toe with. So in a way, it's here he's saying, I'm your servant, but that I live with Lavan, and I was able to handle that. So he's kind of saying to him, on the other hand, even though I'm presenting myself in a subservient way, but also I was able to handle myself with the tricky Lavan, okay? But then he says to him, I've acquired much wealth. I've acquired cattle, asses, sheep, and male and female slaves, and I send this message to my Lord in the hope of gaining your favor. So here he is, he's sending this, and then they come back. The messenger returned to Jacob saying, we came to your brother Esau, and he himself is coming to meet you, and there are 400 men with him. So now, how do we take that? The fact that Esau's coming with 400 men seems to be that he's coming with an army of some sort. But the flip side, in terms of this idea of the Gam Holech Likrascha, the idea that he's coming to greet you or to meet you, Likrascha, is found somewhere else. It says that God tells Moses that your brother Aaron will come to greet you as well. So it's interesting, Likrascha here, it seems it could be, again, taken as ominous. Here he's come with 400 men. But when he comes to meet you, he's coming to see you. Perhaps he's coming also, on the other hand, in a positive way. Okay? Now, What's his reaction to hearing this? Yaakov gets scared. Vayirah Yaakov Me'od. Jacob was greatly frightened in his anxiety, and he divided the people with him and the flocks and the herds and the camels into two camps. In the Hebrew, Vayirah Yaakov Me'od, he got very scared. Vayetzer lo, became extremely anxious. So it's like, the idea that you have a double entendre, like this idea that it's not just that he was afraid, but that he got anxious. Like, what do you have to tell me, though? Like, if he's afraid, he's afraid. Like, you're doubling up. So there's this constant, we're going to see, the Beis Halevi, which is a more contemporary, lived in the 1800s, like, has this observation of the duality that's occurring here. That on one hand, we're greeting an Esav, and on another hand, we're meeting a brother. And that this constantly is going back and forth. But this idea that it's telling us the fear and the anxiety is, maybe fear is one negative. Anxiety might be, I'm anxious. I'm anxious to meet, you know, like I have social anxiety, you know, like I'm anxious about this. Okay. And then comes and says, so Yaakov, the rabbis explain that what Yaakov's now going to do is he's going to take a three-prong approach. The three-prong approach is he's going to get ready for battle. So he's practically on the ground getting ready. At the same time, he's sending gifts. He's going to basically say, look, I'm going to put his best foot forward and try to, in a sense, buy off his brother. And the third thing is he's going to pray. Okay, so here he does the first thing practically. He splits the camp in two. And he says, if Esav comes to the one camp and attacks it, the other camp may yet escape. So he's like, the worst case scenario, if this goes bad, at least we'll have a partial survival. So half the camp will go, half the camp will be saved. Okay, so that's pretty negative. Then Yaakov says, he prays. Then Jacob said, O God of my father Abraham and the God of my father Yitzchak, O Lord who said to me, return to your native land, I will deal bountifully with you. So then he says, this is continuing in his prayer, I am unworthy of all the kindness that you have so steadfastly shown your servant. With my staff alone, I crossed this Jordan. Now I have become two camps. So he says, he's praising God. Thank you so much. You've given more than I deserve. And then he says, deliver me, Hatzileni na, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esav. So miyad achi, Miyad Esav, is like he's splitting up here. This is the duality of save me from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esav. So it could just say from the hand of my brother Esav, but it says no, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esav. So again, there are two things that are going on here, because I'm afraid, I fear he may come and strike me down, mothers and children alike, right? So that he's going to take the whole family down. And not just take me out, but also destroy the whole entire family. So then he continues on in his prayer. Yet you have said, I will deal bountifully with you and make your offspring as the sands of the sea, which are too numerous to count. You promised me, like before I left, this is at the vision of the ladder. It says that you're going to give me this bountiful offspring and nation. So that's it. So save me, and You had already told me, you promised me that you're going to make my family great. So it's an interesting. Now, the rabbis actually, it's so interesting in the way they approach or the way they analyze this prayer. So you would say, If I were to say to you, I am unworthy of all the kindness that you have so steadfastly shown your servant. So I came with nothing and I'm now incredibly wealthy. So you would say, wow, that's fantastic, right? Here he is, he's being so humble. Katonti mikol hachasadim, I'm unworthy of all the kindness. And so some say, well, that's a positive. Look how special Jacob is, so humble. But there are others that understand this as, you know, like in a way, he's saying it as if he's saying, I don't deserve it. And God says, you didn't deserve any of this. I gave this as a purely based on loving kindness. And later on, when his daughter, Dina, is taken and raped, it's almost like the rabbis tie it to this line. Like, here you are, you're saying, I didn't deserve it. So God says, well, you know, I'm going to show you. You know, bad stuff is going to come at you because of the way that you cavalierly said this, perhaps. It's an interesting, I mean, there's a lot of, all these passages are so, again, we're running through it. We could sit and we could take out each, there are multiple commentaries that we could go through to show the spin that there's multiple layers that are in these different passages. But here we're going through kind of on the like a superficial level and a little bit deeper into it. But again, we're gonna have to come back and try to understand, you know, how we understand it. But right now I'm going step by step, trying to show you the subtlety in the language. So fine. So now what happens? After spending the night there, he selected from what was at hand these presents for his brother. So now he starts sending him this massive amount of animals, like almost like a parade, that's going to be as a gift. And he does it in a way so that it should really be, you know, very, very like spread out to look like it's incredibly large. 200 she-goats, 20 he-goats, 20 ewes, 20 rams, 30 milch camels with their colts, 40 cow and 10 bulls, 20 she-asses and 10 he-asses. Like, here's just like, I mean, if you just take the dollar value, even today, this is a substantial gift that he's sending him. And these he put in charge of his servants, drove by drove, and he told his servants, go on ahead and keep a distance between droves. So he's saying, like, spread out. So make it look big. And as they come, he instructed the one in front as follows. When my brother Esav meets you and asks you, whose men are you? Where are you going? And whose animals are these ahead of you? And you shall answer, your servant Jacob's. They are a gift sent to my lord Esav, and Jacob himself is right behind us. So he's like, in a way, like doing this whole incredible regalia, like this huge procession. And each time they come to him, this he's like, it's like, just, you know, like in terms of advertising, right? You know, you're kind of like, you're pushing home this message, right? And here, your servant Jacob, they are gift sent, and he's right behind us. Next thing he sees, another group of gifts, another, you know, it's like one after the other. So you see this idea of the importance of how you present, right? So here's the first advertising, you know, in the Torah, of just like presentation is everything. So he gave similar instructions to the second one, the third, and all the others who followed the droves, namely, thus, and you shall say to Esav when you reach him. Right, so the tremendous amount of gifts. So he's ready for battle, he's prayed, and now he's sending out the gifts. And you shall add, and your servant Jacob himself is right behind us. For he reasoned, if I appropriate him, if I propitiate, I think is, I don't know how you pronounce that word. Ki amar achabra panav bamincha haleches lefanai. Right, so he's saying,
propitiate,
okay. Right, so with presence in advance, and then face him, perhaps he will show me favor, right? So this idea now, he's really like, again, like this idea of a buy-off, or really like buttering him up, okay? So now, and so the gift went on ahead while he remained in camp that night. So now, all this has occurred, he's done, everything's set up, and now, that same night he arose, coming back to what we talked about before, he taking his two wives, his two maidservants, and his 11 children, he crossed the ford of the Yabok. After taking them across the stream, he sent across all his possessions. Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him until the break of dawn. So now, who is this man that he's wrestling till the dawn? Okay, we need to figure that out. And then when he saw that he had not prevailed against him, how ambiguous is this, right? I mean, Vayar Kilo Yacholo. What does that say? Who? Is it that Jacob, or is it talking about the man, right? It's very ambiguous. He wrenched Jacob's, okay, so now, but the fact that the next thing is Vayage Bachaf Yerecho, and he wrenched Jacob's hip at its socket, so that the socket of his hip was strained as he wrestled with him. So now, if I take that as being the man, right, so then it brings me back that I can say that that must be done. The man could not prevail, so therefore he knocked him in the hip. Okay? Then he said, let me go, for dawn is breaking. But he answered, I will not let you go unless you bless me. He said the other, Vayomer Elav, what is your name? He replied, Jacob. So Mashemecha, he said, my name is Jacob. He said, your name shall no longer be Jacob, but Israel, for you have striven with beings divine and human and have prevailed. Jacob asked, pray, tell me your name. But he said, you must not ask my name. And he took leave of him there. So Jacob named the place Peniel, meaning, I have seen a divine being face to face, yet my life has been preserved. The sun rose upon him as he passed Peniel, limping on his hip. That is why the children of Israel to this day do not eat the thigh muscle that is on the socket of the hip, since Jacob's hip socket was wrenched at the thigh muscle. Okay, so now, based on like reading the entire episode, so the conventional understanding is, first things first, is that it's some kind of angel. And that this, even though it identifies Vayavik, a man wrestled with him until the break of dawn, that as it continues on, as we go through the passage, when he names it, your name shall be no longer Jacob, but Israel, for you have striven with beings divine and human, and have prevailed. And then ask his name, and he says, why are you asking my name? Right? And then, you can't ask me my name. And it's interesting. It actually translated, he took leave of him in the Hebrew, Vayevarach oto sham, he blessed him there. So, and then he says, he calls the place Peniel because I have seen a divine being face to face, yet my life has been preserved. So that naming, right, gives us the sense that he had now, this man was no man, but rather some kind of divine being. So the conventional is that, who is this mysterious man, right, the man that he wrestled with? It's none other than the angel of Esav, okay? That's the more like if you go to the you know kindergarten or first grade and they're teaching the kids the midrashim, right? They're going to tell them the kid will say, yeah, that's the angel of Esav, okay? But there are other understandings of that. He actually is wrestling with himself, and where do I get that from? Because the beginning of the sentence says Jacob was left alone. And that in his being alone, he's wrestling with the man who is himself. So it's a very, that's another, what's interesting is, Yaakov of the three patriarchs is, and this is, you know, we think of Abraham as like, he's the one God all going, and Isaac's kind of mysterious, and Jacob is the father of the 12 tribes. But we see he's a complicated, that we see a lot about him, and it's always complicated. He's stealing blessings, he's doing, you know, all this negotiating, he gets obsessed with the sheep of his father-in-law, and then he has this episode with his brother. But Yaakov is the one, we call him the Bechir Ha'avos. He's the three patriarchs, he's like the chosen one, in a sense. The fact that he has the 12 tribes, there's something about him that's on a loftier level in a weird way, or he's taking of the different and character traits of Abraham and Isaac, and he's kind of bringing them together. And at the same time, he's confronting, in a way, he's confronting the world. He's confronting the future of our history. So that in this confrontation of, in general, the whole Esav confrontation. And then here at night, it says that at the end of days, Vayevater Yaakov Levado, that this idea that Jacob's going out alone, at the end of days, that God is going to be alone. And that they run a parallel between this imagery of Yaakov, Jacob alone, and God being alone. That there's like this, you know, like, how, like what? We're comparing a human being to God in terms of this idea of aloneness, of going out alone. But they say that on the throne of glory, there's an image of a human being, and that is the image of Jacob. That going back to last week, when Jacob is having that dream of the ladder and he's sleeping in the place of the temple, the future temple, it says that the angels got so angry, like, how dare this person create, you know, like, sleep in a holy place like that? And then they got shaken by the fact that that's the image that they see. That person's face is on the image of the holy throne, meaning he's clearly a very, you know, lofty soul. So it's a lot of stuff that's going on. So we have a story on a very, you know, on the superficial, like, level of here is he's getting ready for all these different, you know, this confrontation. But what happens that night, either he's confronting Esav, his angel, or he's confronting himself. Now, as we go through from there, you say, like, okay, so what did he self-inflict a wound by the fact that he, you know, like, if you're saying it's actually himself, perhaps that's, you know, you can read each thing into the other one. But what's crazy again is you're back to the ambiguity of this story. Like, the way that the Torah is presenting with such ambiguity, I think the answer a lot of times is that you can have multiple things playing at the same time, and that they're all true in a certain sense. That there's so many. That's the beauty of this world, and the Torah is a reflection of the world. That our world that we live in is so complex, and there's so many layers to everything that goes on. Like, you can see something on the most basic level. We can see things. We can see it with our own eyes. This thing happened. And then later on, you find out that there's like 10 different things that were going on that led up to that thing, that therefore what you were seeing is not even what you were seeing. You didn't even understand it for what you were seeing, right? Like, you know, there's so many different examples of, like, not knowing the context of something, and that when you get the context, it then, like, changes what you saw with your own physical eyes. So here you have this idea of, could be that Yaakov physically, that maybe there was actual man that came out that night and fought with him. Or no, he's fighting with the angel of Esav. Or, again, it could be himself. All these things could be occurring. We see that clearly. It's like, here we have a whole story, okay? What we're getting is, we're in Jacob's mind. Think about this. We go back. The Torah is actually, think about what's gone on here. We have entered into his mind. Jacob was greatly frightened. In his anxiety, he divided the people. So everything that's playing here, we're in Jacob's mind, okay? And so, right, like, at the end of the day, what happens? Let's now go to the next step of the story. When he ends up seeing his brother gives him a big hug and kiss. So all this stuff is, you know, here we've entered in, the Torah has taken us into the character Yaakov, to Jacob's mind, and seeing everything, so that at that night when he goes out there, this could be a reflection of a self-struggle. But what's interesting is this idea of what happens at the end of the struggle, if it's actually himself, or if it's the angel of Asa for that matter, right? You clearly, he's able to overcome and be like the idea that he's no longer Jacob, it becomes Israel. Because you've striven with beings divine and human, and have prevailed. So there's a struggle, but there's also his prevailing. What's interesting is, now what we said at the beginning of this class is that here these are stories that are defining for ourselves as Jews, as Israelites, because we have to remember, we're not just Jews, which means that we come from the tribe of Judah, but we're also identified as Yisrael, as Israel, as the children of Israel. And that's different. You can be B'nai Jacob, you can be the sons of Jacob, of Yaakov, and you can also be the Israel. Like, the idea that the modern state of Israel is called Israel, not some other, you know, Judea, or, you know, like, that name that was given to this new state is not coincidental, I believe, but rather it's a reflection of this other trait, which is Israel and not Jacob and not Jewish. But that's a separate, it's a different identity. And that is something, the ability to be able to struggle and to confront the divine and the human and to prevail means that this idea, but also this idea of having the ability to struggle with and to work on and to battle through, both on a, again, if this is an internal struggle of his own, or if he's going to be having this wrestling match with the, you know, we'll call it the nemesis, the arch nemesis, Esav, Rome, and to be able to prevail, or to be able to have all these things happening at the same time, okay? And so then, therefore, his name is changed, because now he's taken on a greater identity, which is Israel. So like Al-Pi Kabbalah, but the Kabbalistic understanding of this is that we all come from this greater collective soul. And that Jacob, here he is, here's Jacob. He's a person, he's developing the Jewish nation, but he's also going to become Israel. And that we, and that, like when we say fast forward, is that, well, now what becomes like our major, you know, what do we say? We say, Shema Yisrael, hear, O Israel, okay? Who are we saying that to? Hear, O Israel. So we're kind of like, it's like a logging in, so to speak, in today's parlance, right? Where we're saying, okay, I'm tapping in, I'm here, going to connect to something that's called Israel, which, again, we call is the greater collective Jewish soul. So here in this story, we see that there's this idea of this episode that he's going through, this struggle that he goes through, that becomes identified as being able to struggle with and prevail, that becomes so identity, becomes definitional, becomes defining to we as a nation of what we're going to be about. So now, going forward into history, this is our, you know, look back, like we're constantly going through these struggles and battling, and ultimately we hope we prevail, but the idea is that we see that there is this kind of struggle that's going to be who we, what, that's like, that's what we're all about. So here the prevailing thing you want to focus on, but it's really about the idea of the struggle. And so that we see that this is what's happening here. And the fact that he wants to know, tell me your name, can't tell you my name, right? So is that about himself, like knowing like who you are on the deepest level? Or if he's talking to the angel of Esav, that there's no name, or you can't really define when it comes to the celestial or to those higher beings, because they don't have a definition in the way we understand definition in the physical world. But either way, we see that he clearly has, whether he's now come in contact with his greater soul, right? I have seen a divine being face to face. So is he seen his own, the divinity of himself, or that of, you know, the Sarah Shal Esav, again, the angel of Esav, or, right? So he's seeing something he's experienced, but he's telling us, that's what I've seen. I've seen a divine being face to face, and my life has been preserved. So there's this idea that, as perhaps understanding for ourselves, that when it comes to our confrontation with ourselves, with the divine, with that which is greater and more in the spiritual realm, or that which is bigger than any of us, that it's clearly something that is dangerous or scary, and or call it frightening. But that what he's saying here is that it's something that, it on one hand, there is a feeling of when we go beyond ourselves. Let's say we talk about God, like the Tanya, when he defines, one of the things he does there, in this is the first Lubavitcher Rebbe in his monumental book called the Tanya, he talks about the idea of meditation about God, and God is defined as the Ein Sof, the endless one. So when we start to think in that direction, it's beyond, you know, like we're talking about the endless one, that, you know, relating to God in that way is frightening. It's like there's something that's much bigger and endless that's daunting, right? So here we see that there is this, you know, it's something like you see this whole parsha, this whole story has tremendous fear and anxiety that Yaakov is experiencing. And if we're saying it's a metaphysical spiritual struggle, so then there's something that when we approach that world, it can be very frightening. But he see that what Yaakov is laying the pathway for us, he charts that path for us, that this is something that we have the ability to conquer, to be able to experience, to be able to go after. Now, what's interesting is he does walk away limping. He limps on his hip because this is something that potentially is fraught with potential danger. So we have to understand that there is that balance that we have to always recognize as we go in this. So much so that we have, till today, you can't eat a certain part of the cow because of this incident. You know, the idea of the leg of a person is our stability, our ability to stand, and that was damaged in this incident. Again, very interesting. There's a lot there. I'm not going to go into it now because the rabbis talk about the idea of what, if we're going to take it as Saro Shalesov, if it is the angel of Esav, and he went after that hip of Jacob, that is another whole story to develop in terms of what does that mean in terms of Rome, in terms of the Western society going after our ability to support ourselves. Okay, but either way, right now, I've clearly taken us in the direction of more of the metaphysical aspect of this, of where we're struggling with ourselves, or even with the idea of Esav as that nemesis, arch nemesis of our ability to develop. Okay, so now, he finally sees his brother with the 400 people. He divides the kids and his wives and the maidservants, putting the maids and their children first, Leah and her children next, and Rachel and Joseph last. What's interesting here is you see who he puts, you know, in danger's way first and kind of protects Rachel and Joseph. That's like going back to we see that he always has that special care for Rachel and Joseph and that side. And then he himself went on ahead and bowed low to the ground 7 times until he was near his brother. This is a very quick parenthetical. V'hu avar lifnehem. He himself went on ahead. V'hu avar lifnehem. We have this idea, this is a total aside, but it's just an interesting aside, that we have an idea that when you do a mitzvah, we always make a blessing before that mitzvah. If it's a mitzvah that has a bracha before it, a blessing, the blessing has to be made before you actually do the mitzvah. For example, you're going to have you're going to put on tefillin, or you're going to put on, or you're going to break bread. You're going to let's use those two. Right before you do the mitzvah, you make the blessing first, because we say it's over la'asiyatan. You do it before you make the blessing before you do the act of the mitzvah. The in Hebrew, avar is past tense. Like if you're studying Hebrew, avar is past. Hu avar lifnehem. Normally, I would say you would do something lifne. So lifne, but avar is to pass or past tense. So v'hu avar lifnehem is the source. This is the source that the rabbis use to teach us that you're supposed to make the blessing before you do the mitzvah, which is kind of weird because if avar is past, to pass in front of, or to be the past behind, so how is that a way of telling me the future? It's a very strange kind of construct for teaching me this idea of before something. Okay? So the idea of who avar lifnehem, what's going on? So now we take a step back. Let's give ourselves context. Here he is. He's coming in front of his brother. This is all this stuff that just occurred. He set up the camps for war, right? He prayed to God. He sent a crazy amount. He sent probably millions of dollars worth of animals as gifts to his brother, okay? He has this struggle the night preceding this. And then he finally confronts his brother, coming with 400 men. and he gets the and he puts the he lines up the family, and then Vehu Avar Lifneihem, and then he himself went on ahead and bowed low to the ground 7 times until he was near his brother. So what's going on? So we have Yaakov, we have Jacob, like, there's a lot going on here, right? The amount of, like, you know, like if we're watching a movie, like this is like a build up to this, like this moment, 30 plus years, all this stuff. He's clearly so, like, you know, anxious about and afraid of what's going to go down here. And then Vehu Avar Lifneihem. So he's clearly very much in the moment as he passes in front. Yeah?
One quick question.
Yep.
All this in Jacob's head, or does he have a reason to be worried that his brother wants to kill him or war with him, or is this all just a construct in his head and in his, you know, in his mind?
So what do you think I'm going to answer you? I'm going to say both.
Well, what's the reason for him fearing his brother? What
So the fear is built on the fact that he feels like he definitely slighted his brother by taking the blessings, right? And before that, like, if you know, and it came to the blessings at that time, it says that Esau's reaction when he found out about it is that my brother messed me over twice, because he bought the rights of the firstborn, and now he's taking the blessings. Okay, so Esau is slighted. It says,
and there's been no contact with them since then.
That's correct.
This is the first time there's contact since that happened.
That's what we're told. Yes.
Got it.
Okay.
Okay.
So is it all in his head? No. But the answer is, in a lot of things in life, like half of it or more than half of it is in our heads, right? Like, you could be sitting there obsessing for hours about something, and then you get there and it's like nothing. It's like the completely opposite of what you thought was going to go down, right? So here we have, you can sit and, like, do a psychoanalysis of this whole story. It's, you know, now again, to answer your question, does he have every right to be afraid? Yes. And the reality is Esav is clearly, if I understand the story as he messed him over twice, brother wanted to kill him. The Torah tells us after that taking of the blessings, he wanted to kill Yaakov.
Okay.
Okay.
I didn't realize there was no contact between them since then.
Right. So the Torah tells us, actually the rabbis tell us, that the reason why he comes to Laban's house penniless is because Esav had sent out his son Eliphaz to kill Yaakov, and Yaakov, being his uncle, said, "You don't really want to kill me." "Yeah, I don't really want to kill you, but my father sent me to kill you." So he said, "Okay, I'll give you all my money. A poor man's like a dead person, and therefore you have fulfilled your obligation to your father of making me a dead man by making me poor." That's the story that the rabbis tell us, okay? Because that explains how could he not have, coming from Isaac's house, he had a tremendous amount of wealth. Where'd the wealth go when he shows up at his uncle's door? And that's how they explain it. So, but in terms of anybody else making, you know, any type of communication, it seems that they had no communication. Right? So it's like there's a lot of unknown as to, like, and then all these years later, you know, it's like here, like, you know, the family members didn't talk for 30 years, you know, and then they finally meet up. And I say, who is this telling us? We were at a meal a couple of weeks ago. And I remember the story. We were at a meal a couple of weeks ago, and this woman was telling how her father and her uncle did not get along, and that there were years that they had not spoken, and they finally meet up after all those years, and they realize they still didn't like each other. It was like it was pretty funny, but here, you, like, you know what's going to go down here, right? So it's like so much that's going on, but. What's interesting is that on the deepest, deepest level, what the rabbis tell us is that Jacob sees this as, like, this is going to be a foundational, historical, you know, meta event that's going, like, this is, like, is so, like, defining in terms of our future, in terms of how we're going to, interact with the powers that be that become Rome, that become Western civilization, and that we're gonna have this, you know, and anything, it could be a precursor also to like the Hanukkah story in a certain sense of like there's this fear of, and like what you know, just to give us a little bit of a Hanukkah flavor here, is that when the Greeks come, the biggest challenge of Hanukkah and the Greek, you know, story, the whole Hanukkah story, is that their culture became like embedded into us to the point where we became, you know, people like actually became so attracted to the Greek way of approach to life that it became all encompassing and to the point of loss of Jewish identity. So, you know, here you have this confrontation that you're going to see, like here you have, on one hand, you're Esav, which is not a negative, it's a negative, and then he's also his brother. So he's Esav, miyad achim, miyad Esav. He's afraid of the Esav side, but he's also afraid of his brother. Like, what happens if he comes with open hands, open arms, and embraces him and says, "Let's be together"? He's afraid that that will become like America, like in the sense that all said and done, maybe there's a rise of anti-Semitism, but as our Jewish history goes, like as a society, America's never, you know, that's one of the most welcoming societies in our history in terms of, you know, really never really held back from being able to acculturate and, you know, integrate into American society. So that's where Yaakov is afraid of my brother, as opposed to the Esav side. All right, so he when he finally goes in front of him, just to get back to this idea of who avar lifnehem, so when the rabbis like learn and understand that the idea of making a blessing before doing something is from this episode, when Yaakov goes in front of him, he's so in the moment, he's so focused, that that's how really we're supposed to be when we do a mitzvah, when we're doing it, like a, whether it's like making a blessing before we eat, or when we're doing a birchas a mitzvah, like we're gonna, you know, something like a you know, taking a lulav and esrog, or, you know, the tefillin I gave as an example, but like something that's not a pleasure type of thing of eating, but rather you're doing some kind of like lighting candles, right? So all those things that we call those are mitzvah, right? So we make the blessing before we do the mitzvah. By candle lighting, the reason we first light the candles and then make the blessing is because the light, the blessing is when we accept the Shabbos. So there you would actually make the blessing after you light the candles and then make the blessing. Because once you make the blessing, you accept the Shabbos, so it's like the flip. But normally, so like the idea though of the blessing in learning from this episode is to be in the moment, to be focused, to like have, to be very present, just like Yaakov was when he goes in front of Esav. And then ultimately what happens? Esav ran to greet him, he embraced him, and falling on his neck, he kissed him, and they wept. So it's like, whoa, after all of that, he embraces him and then kisses him and they cry. Now what's interesting is this phrase, Vayipol al Tzavarav and Vayishakehu, you see how there are these stars on top or these dots? So it's even understood here in the dualism, because on one hand I could read it the way I just read it, which is that it seems like it was a love fest. The flip side is, what does it mean he fell on his neck? Like, you fall on someone's neck. So some say that he actually tried to bite him. You know, it's like, so you have, you know, like you can read the same sentence in a positive way, or that there was like a little bit of that, you know, negativity that was still there. It wasn't all perfect. But, you know, here after all this, you have this embracing. So like the idea of the relationship that's going to go for the future of the Jewish people, of Israel, together with Rome into the Western world, is going to be complicated, that you're going to have this, you know, again, this whole story of the you know, the enemy, the nemesis, or the friend. So there are different accounts in history where we say that the, you know, Judaism and Rome were in step, and they were working together. In terms of who built the society that we have today, in terms of, you know, the way we have the, you know, our business is set up, we have, you know, societies that are built in you know, with we're settled society in terms of cities and plumbing and all the great ways of how our world has developed into a positive in terms of having quality of life, etc. So that's more of Rome than, you know, today we're proud of the fact that Israel is like bringing all this great new ingenuity, but in terms of historically, the roads, the infrastructure, in terms of civilization, that was more of Esav and Rome, okay? So how we, the Jewish people, how we, Israel, integrates into that, and this is like something that's already starting from the beginning of time with Jacob and the story of he and his brother Esav. And then it goes on, and then he just says, looking about, he saw the women and the children. Who, he asked, are these with you? He answered, the children with whom God has favored your servant. Now, what's interesting is, from this exchange, again, in the subtlety, look at the subtlety of approach to life. Then the maids with their children came forward and bowed low. Next, Leah and with her children came forward and bowed low. And last, Joseph and Rachel came forward and bowed low. Interesting. Notice how here there's a change. First, it's Leah and her children, but then here it goes, Joseph preceded his mother, as if to show us that Joseph has this like ability to become one that can stand in front of Esav and whatever he represents. He has, and it becomes like representative of the aspect of the Jewish people that's able to really not just confront society, but to excel in society. Like we see later on when Joseph goes down to Egypt, he doesn't just, you know, survive. He becomes the guy, right? So that's interesting that he comes before Rachel here. And he asked, so this is Esav, what do you mean by all this company which I have met? He answered, to gain my Lord's favor. So he says, who's this whole camp that I've met here? And he says, it's for me to find favor. So now what does Esav say? Esav says, I have enough. Yesh li rav. I have a lot, my brother. Let what you have remain yours. And then what does Yaakov say? He says, his answer is different. Whereas Esav says, I have a lot, which means he could always have more. Yaakov's understanding is, take my gift because v'chi yesh li kol. I have not just plenty, but I have it all. As opposed to the idea of Rav, he has all, which means I have everything I need. So that subtlety in the language, the rabbis point out, is everything that you need to know about how we should approach life based on the teachings of what Yaakov was about, what Jacob was about. Because when they come together, this little subtlety here is everything. Esav sees the world as I have a lot, which means I can always have more. And Yaakov says, I have everything. Chiyesh li kol. I have all. Because it's, what I have is what I need. And that's it. And that's like this little subtlety that you have here between the two here. But when you take it out, it means it's everything. It's so massive in terms of how different it is. And then Esav actually wants to stay together with his brother. And Yaakov says, no, I have little children. They're going to take long. They can't really travel with you. And so ultimately he encourages Esav to go, and Esav goes away. And Esav started back that day on his way to Seir, and Jacob journeyed on to Sukkot and built a house for himself and made stalls for his cattle. That is why the place was called Sukkot. Now, there's a whole like thing of like, it's like not just a coincidence that it's the Sukkah, but after a confrontation, like i.e. Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, they'll need to go to Sukkot. That's a whole nother, rabbis have fun with that. But I think it's important is that when you look at this story, first of all, you see how many, like the ambiguity of the story. The man comes to wrestle with him. Like you have all this stuff going on. I think it's amazing to see like how the Torah is giving us, they're bringing us into Yaakov's mind. That a lot of what goes on here is very much in, not to take anything away from it, but the idea of giving us access into how he's seeing things and experiencing things, but then how he goes, like when the rabbis took this parsha and they used it to study the way they should approach Rome, is to teach us like how we should approach, you know, here, if we're going to go into a situation that we're worried about, we should pray, we should be practical, we have to do what we need to do, And we should, you know, if it means in that case that they need to find favor, you do things that are going to present yourself in a way that's going to find favor by either giving gifts or being praised, you know, full of praise, etc. But it's a very practical approach. And then at the same time, remember that you need to also remember that God at the end of the day is running the show, and therefore you need to pray. So you have all these different things. That's not one without the other. But then it taking us back into Yaakov, that his personal struggle, the personal side of things, that we have to be cognizant of that we have, as much as there's a lot going on outside of us, there's a lot going on internally that we are struggling with, that we need to address. You can't just like say, ah, it's nothing. You see that Yaakov, when we read it that way, but the beauty of the Torah's rendition here is that you see there's so many, the ambiguity leaves it open for us to be able to find the layers of meaning of all the different things that are all playing at the same time. Okay? So I think we'll leave it here. Any questions or comments? You're all muted, so you can't even speak. Okay, Victoria.
I think we can all relate to this parsha in so many different ways. I think we all, at some point, battle within ourselves what Jacob was battling. So I often, in my mind, refer to this parsha and what Jacob and the anxiety and everything that we all often have before we're going to do something. It's definitely a very relatable parsha.
You can see also, like, that's like the thing about it in context, like Avram and Yitzchak, Abraham and Isaac, we don't get this type of, we don't think it's amazing. The Torah is giving us such an, like, a insight.
Just the humility also.
Yeah, you see, it's like there's so much. Yeah. And you see, it's like so real. Very real.
It's awesome. Thank you.
You're welcome.
It was great.
Thank you very
much.
You're welcome. Thank you, Jonathan. Have a good evening.
Have a great.
Bye-bye.
Okay, great week, guys.
Have a good week.
All right, all the best.
Bye, everyone.